Welcome back to Curious Medicine. I'm Christy.
I'm Brian.
And today we're talking about lithotomy. Brian, have you ever had a lithotomy?
I have not. Isn't that where they cut a hole in your head and take out a part of your brain to make you normal again?
No, that's a lobotomy. Oh. I think maybe you did the wrong research.
I had that, but I didn't have the... No.
Sounds like it. You must have had a lobotomy after I told you we were doing lithotomy this week.
That's what it was.
Well, we're going to get into what a lithotomy is, but this really has to do with bladder stones. And so let's back up a little bit. Brian, have you ever had a bladder stone?
I have not had a bladder stone, but as I've mentioned on this podcast numerous times, I've served in the military and I have seen quite a few professional tough guys when I was deployed overseas brought down to their knees in tears, literally in tears. I remember one guy, special forces guy, is one of the toughest human beings that you could possibly imagine, in tears, drinking as much water as he could while they put him in CT to assess a kidney stone.
Yeah.
I mean, he was in, it was, and I told myself there's no way I ever want to go through this. So, and when I talked to the doctors to find out like what causes it, and they give you the kind of, well, we don't really know.
Just, yeah.
You know,
it could be a lot of things.
Just got to drink a lot of water. And then that was it. I was just downing water every 5 seconds. So.
Stay hydrated. Yeah. Avoid this. Avoid that. Hope you don't have a family history. Well, so kidney stones and bladder stones are a little bit different in their, you know, the way that they're formed and the reasons why you get them. And we're going to talk very briefly about that. But today we're focusing on bladder stones. I also have never had a bladder stone, but I do have urinary urgency and frequency, which are two of the symptoms associated with having bladder stones. And
but wait a minute, time out. Every woman I've ever known, and especially every woman I've ever dated, has urinary frequency and urgency at all times, especially during a movie.
Well, so, wait till you get a little older and the women, drive. Well, now you're married, but wait till you get a little older, because you're about 10 years behind me and I'm approaching 50, and I'm here to tell you that my bladder ain't what it used to be and it gets worse. And maybe it's from holding my urine for so many years because of a job-related situation. But no, about a year ago, I had gone hiking, and my friend and I were with a meetup group. I had driven, and I knew that I needed to use the restroom. We had driven far away. But I didn't want to be that girl, you know, that caused my friend to miss the hike. So I was just like, I'll just deal with it. So we get there, we start hiking. So from the moment I parked the car, I felt like I had to pee. We go on this hike. The hike turns into this situation where they wanted to take some trail that had a really weird drop off that you essentially really had to hang by your hands to drop down this little cliff like thing to get to the next level. And I was just not comfortable with it. I had so many apprehensions, and I had to pee. This is hours into the hike, and I had to pee. And I'm like,
holding on for dear life.
Yeah. And I'm like, I do not feel comfortable with this. So I told my friend, I said, I don't want to do this. And there were other people on our hike that also didn't want to have to do this. So there were maybe six or eight of us that decided, you know what, we're just going to turn back and just go home. So this six or eight of us with one of the leaders of this hike, actually, we all decide that we're going to turn around. We start going back to where the direction that we think is the car, and we get lost. Now, not only have I had to pee for the whole time that we've been hiking, now I'm having, you know, now I'm just like super focused on it because we're lost. And I don't want to go off trail and go pee because I don't know these people. And I also don't want to fall behind from them because we're already lost. And I'm thinking, well, at least there's one of the group leaders is trying to get us back to the car. I don't think we have any hope without him. So I didn't want to be like, oh, wait a minute, let me go off in the bush and pee. So I held my pee this whole time. It was like, I don't know how many hours it was, but it was probably like a 4 hour hike to start with. This probably lasted about 6 or 8 hours in the end. And by the time we got to my car, I had the worst migraine headache. And I think it was just from the stress and concentration of not wetting myself the whole time. But oh my God, it was terrible. So when I was doing this research and realizing the torture that comes with bladder stones, especially back in the day, I felt really bad for these people and very empathetic.
So the definition of lithotomy is the surgical removal of a calculus or a stone from the bladder. The word lithotomy actually comes from the Greek for lithos, meaning stone, and tomos, meaning cut.
It was extremely painful because there was no anesthesia in the earliest days. And it was also extremely risky because they didn't know about, you know, infection control and things like that. There were no antibiotics. And also they also didn't really know about anatomy. So there was like severe bleeding. So if you didn't die from post-operative infection after this procedure, or if you didn't bleed to death during the procedure, then you probably developed incontinence, wounds that wouldn't heal, and also in men, erectile dysfunction. You know, so there's something nice to look forward to.
In studying this, it actually, and looking at the research here, it actually made me think, like, okay, well, how do they know? Because nowadays, if you have a stone, there's all kinds of high-tech imaging they can do and all kinds of things to be able to accurately diagnose the fact that you have a calculus.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure back then, people passed stones all the time. And so you would pass, you know, people, you've heard of people passing a stone. So they probably mm-hmm. would equate, okay, the pain is obviously associated with some sort of stone.
Oh,
but if
yeah.
it was too big to pass, and yeah. there's no imaging or anything like that, then,
right.
you know, they
could yeah, we're going to talk about all that.
Together.
How did they know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm, we're going to get into that. But let's talk about, Brian, have you ever heard of the lithotomy position?
I have, actually, and I thought it was something else.
What did you think it was?
I thought it was the position that women are put in for pelvic exams.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is, mm-hmm. and childbirth.
And childbirth.
Yeah, so it is the same position, but it didn't originate with childbirth or pap smears. That's not where that position originated from. It originated from this procedure that we're talking about today. So let me describe the lithotomy position, Brian. You lay on your back with your buttocks at the end of the table or whatever surface you're laying on, which could be any surface back in the day. Your hips are flexed, your knees are bent and separated, and this is sometimes described as jackknifed. Doesn't that sound lovely? And all of your private parts are just right out there, you know, the most accessible that they can be.
I feel like you need to do that again, and this time we need to do like some soft, like saxophone
mood music
in the background. Imagine your hips up yeah. against the table.
Yeah. Or like a yoga class where they're like, okay, close your eyes. Now lift those legs.
Ladies, lift those thighs.
Yeah. Breathe in. So we've already talked about the consequences of lithotomy. Let's talk about what bladder stones are and how they originate and all that good stuff. First of all, these have occurred throughout human history. Essentially, bladder stones are small mineral deposits that turn into crystals in the bladder. They create this gritty sediment, which is typically excreted in your urine without you even noticing. But when they don't get excreted, while they're still really tiny and small enough to pass unnoticed, these larger stones are formed, and they form in layers like an onion or like a tree trunk. This is caused by a bacteria in the urine, which is not normal. Normally, our urine does not have bacteria. And bacteria in the urine is a direct result of poor hygiene. Typically, this has affected the lower socioeconomic class. It's more common in men. For centuries, people didn't take daily baths in clean water. For example, the water in the canals were essentially sewer water, and they contained everything from human waste to dead varmints to chemicals. So their private parts were all dirty and yucky all the time. And bacteria could easily travel up the urethra.
from dead varmints.
Yeah. Yeah.
I like how you're doing varmints.
Yeah.
She's from Texas, y'all.
Yeah. Yeah. And also, people wore thick clothing day and night. So obviously, they didn't wear clean clothes as often as we do now. Even when they did try to wash their clothes, they were using this disgusting sewer water to do so. Mm-hmm. Mm, so funky. I know your nose is all crinkled up like mine is. Now, if you urinated on a regular basis, you could flush out the urethra, ridding it of these bacteria. But that meant drinking lots of fluids, and it was hard to find clean drinking water, which meant people drank a lot of beer and wine. And in some cultures, they would drink up to a liter of beer per day.
You know, on a side note, I actually just heard something about this, mm-hmm. and it turned out that they were in different areas, like in Germany, for instance. Mm-hmm. They were masters at brewing at this bit, mm-hmm. at a certain point in history. They actually made two different kinds of ale and beer. One was a little bit weaker because children had to drink it.
Oh.
And so it was still beer, but it was the alcohol content was much weaker. And then if you wanted to get hammered, you had that beer
for the adults. Yeah, the fun kind and the boring kind.
Yeah,
I was going to say, but children weren't drinking beer and wine, so bladder infections often began in childhood. Mm-hmm. By adulthood, the stones could have grown quite large. But these bladder stones, they can also develop when a person is just dehydrated or when the urine becomes very concentrated, such as when there is urinary stasis due to urinary retention. The sediment turns the stone large enough to obstruct the passage of urine. An enlarged prostate can prevent complete emptying of the bladder. So as you get older, men are affected by enlarged prostate. The sad thing is, once you have a stone that's large enough to cause urinary retention, this starts this whole cycle of repeat infections, which causes the stone to become even larger. Okay, some of these stones, Brian, you have a really disconcerted look on your face.
You just said, as I get older, my prostate's going to get bigger. Yeah. I'm going to get a stone in my bladder. It's just, I'm not happy right now.
Yeah, your problems are going to be worse than my little urgency and frequency. You're going to have the same issues, but to boot, you're going to have an enlarged prostate. Never fear. This isn't. There's help for your potentially enlarged prostate. Okay. Some of these bladder stones are asymptomatic, but when they aren't, these are going to be some of the symptoms, which may be intermittent or episodic, with the exception of pain. Pain is more or less constant and can be excruciating. But frequent urination. Okay, so let me describe what happens when you have urinary frequency. There's a sensor at the base of your bladder, and that gets stimulated when the bladder is full. The reason that sensor gets stimulated is because it's your body telling you, you know, it's time to go urinate. That's what happened to me on my hike. When there's a stone sitting on this sensor, you get the same urge even if the bladder isn't full. When you do try to urinate, this stone blocks the exit of urine so that not much comes out. And then this creates a cycle of unrelenting urgency. So that is not what happened to me because I don't have a stone. But anyway, it's pretty miserable apparently. So some of the other symptoms, you can have difficult urination. So maybe you're able to pee, but it's hard to pee. And it can also be painful urination. You can have fever because of infection, and you can have severe lower abdominal and back pain with associated nausea, vomiting, and chills. And probably the reason for the lower abdominal and back pain is most likely because if you have a stone that's obstructing your urinary output, so you can't urinate, you know, there's nowhere for your urine to go, your body's still creating urine, your bladder can become overly distended. That's painful. It can also back up into the ureters, which is the tube that goes from the kidneys to the bladder. It can make those distended. That can cause back pain. And then you can also have such degree of urinary stasis that your kidneys, you know, the part where the urine drains out of the kidneys, that part can become overly dilated, which is like a condition called hydronephrosis. So it can just back up the whole system, just like a clogged pipe. Let's see. You can also have blood in your urine. Bladder stones, they can vary in number. So you can have one or you can have multiple. They can vary in size and shape, but they can also vary in texture. So some are really smooth on the outside, but some are really very...
they look like rocks.
Like, yeah.
Looking rocks.
Yes, jaggedy rocks. Yeah, yeah. Like, I'm trying to think of what those... I'm a country girl, so... Those round, like cockleburros, that's what I call them. They're like these round little stickers.
Oh, I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah. They get in your socks and then they're poking you and you're like, oh my God, they can become really big.
A good friend of mine had a bladder stone and, he had it, I think he saved it and he showed everybody.
Uh-huh.
It looked like a rock. It looked like a decorative lawn, like what you'd buy if you want to decorate your front yard.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it was a significant size.
Yeah.
And this dude is like, you know, he's not,
he's not a wuss.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. But yeah. And he passed it through his urethra.
He passed it.
Through his urethra, I want to emphasize.
Yes, through his urethra.
It's not quite as bad when a woman does as a man, because your urethra is quite a bit longer than a woman's. My mom suffered from kidney stones when I was like a young teenager. And she had one stone that she passed that was the size of a lima bean, but it was real smooth. It didn't hurt at all when she passed that stone. The only reason she knew she passed a kidney stone is because she heard it clink when it hit the toilet.
Oh,
but she saved it to show her doctor. And he said, oh yeah, the reason that it wasn't painful is because it's very smooth. It was smooth like a lima bean. But not long after that, she passed when she was having to strain her urine to assess for passing stones, because I think maybe she had had, maybe she, I don't know, maybe she was going to have lithotripsy or had lithotripsy. I don't know. Anyway, so she was straining her urine and she passed just the tiniest one, but it was so painful. She thought she was going to die. I mean, it was so painful, but it was the tiniest one, but it was all jaggedy like that. So they are very painful. I can't imagine having to go through a penile urethra because it's so much longer than a woman's. Anyway, sorry about that.
I have my water bottle here. I'm going to drink some water.
Okay. There is good news, Brian. There's good news for you.
Thank you.
Formation of bladder stones in modern times usually occurs in developing countries and in young boys from rural or impoverished areas. So I don't really think that you, in this day and age, you don't really have to worry about the formation of bladder stones. Also, formation of bladder stones in industrialized countries are pretty rare, except in persons with urinary retention for those various reasons of like things like enlarged prostate, or maybe if you're paralyzed and you no longer have control over your bladder and you have to like drain it with a tube, you have to manually do that, and or nerve damage. Those are some reasons that you might have urinary retention today in an industrialized country. But interestingly, over the past 100 years, as the incidence of bladder stones has decreased, the incidence of kidney stones has increased.
Hmm.
Yeah. So kidney stones develop for different reasons and have different chemical compositions. So the two diseases are really separate.
So it's interesting when you go back into the history of this procedure and just bladder stones in general. The oldest urological object on record is a bladder stone or calculus that was found in the body of a 16-year-old Egyptian male. It was excavated in the early 1900s.
Did you say 60 or 16?
16.
Oh, yeah. 16. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So the object was actually, unfortunately, broken up by an excavating workman, but the damaged specimen was presented to the Museum of Royal College of Surgeons in 1901, and after that, it was destroyed completely when the college was bombed, damaged in bombing in 1941. So,
oh my God, people, get a hold of your artifacts.
Yes, our oldest urological kidneys or bladder stone is no longer exists, but we do have records of that. But Egypt actually is one of the first areas that's mentioned in trying to figure out a way to deal with bladder stones. And one of the ways that's actually that they did this, which I thought was absolutely insane, the person who, I guess the doctor in this case, or the healer, would have an assistant working with him. And this is, when I tell this story, I want you to think about what it would be like to be a PA.
Okay. Okay. All right.
The urethra was dilated. And remember, the urethra is the tube that carries the urine from the bladder out to the world, right?
Yes.
So the urethra was dilated by a wooden or cartilaginous cannula, quote, as thick as the thumb.
I'm looking at my thumb, and my thumb is not even as big as a typical man's thumb.
Yeah, like whose thumb?
Right, probably the doctor performing it, or whoever was
and
performing
if he's wearing
it, which
size
is probably
eights,
a man.
Yeah, if he's wearing size 8s. Yeah,
he ain't wearing no size 6, yeah.
So the cannula was pushed in with great force, alternating with blowing down the urethra.
Wait.
Cannula's
the
pushed
cannula
in.
Is pushed in. Mm-hmm. They push and then they blow.
Exactly.
Oh my lord! Okay. So there.
We're not at the assistant
is this
yet.
Where no. comes from? I'm sorry, close. I couldn't resist. I mean, come on! You walked me right into that one.
I'm actually getting there. The stone was then pressed into the perineum by the fingers in the rectum until it could be reached from the urethra, or wait for it, sucked out by the mouth.
Oh. This is even worse than the cataract thing.
So, like
really?
I said, think about being a PA at this time.
And no, you know, I thought the cataract thing was bad.
Oh, no, this one. Or what if you do both? Like, what if you work for a doctor that does it? You know those procedures that we
just
don't
like
doing?
Yes, because I told you in the cataract procedure one that the guy was an oculist and a lithotomist.
Oh, so his PA.
Worst job ever.
Can you imagine getting the schedule and you're like, oh, I have a cataract and a lithotomy before
suddenly,
lunch?
Suddenly, cataracts just got better.
So, yeah, I don't know. It didn't say anything about the mortality rate or the morbidity or like the effectiveness of this treatment or anything like that, but they do know that this is how this was done. So,
wow.
Yeah. And so the reason that they knew that, I thought this part was interesting, that I'm sure by looking at the stone, they probably figured out what it was, but they actually analyzed the stone that was found with the Egyptian mummy, and it had uric acid nucleus with concentric laminations of calcium oxalate and ammonium magnesium phosphate, which is a really, really complicated way of saying that it was a freaking stone. So, yeah. So Egypt, I think, pioneered some techniques, and we're going to talk a little bit about the fact that operations for stone removal had been performed by Hindus, which we're going to talk about, well before the Christian era. And then we move over to Mesopotamia. Early literary references to stone disease actually talk about medical texts where they mention specifically, you know, dealing with stone disease, and they know this because the texts actually start off with things like, if a man is sick with stone, then you do blah, blah, blah. And the same thing with Persia, methods of, and some of these areas, they didn't necessarily go right to lithotomy, but they did try to figure out ways to deal with stones. And so there were some non-surgical treatments that they kind of employed. Mm-hmm. And this was just, you know, herbal home remedies, you know.
Yeah.
And so in Mesopotamia, for instance, the dissolving treatments that they use are black saltpeter, shell of ostrich egg, pine turpentine, and, wait for it, the sexual part of a she-ass. I'll let everyone pause and figure out what that is.
Why the sexual part?
I have a theory.
Seriously?
I have a theory that...
Why not the hoof or something?
I have a theory that back in the day, the people that made this stuff up were kidding. And somebody was like, okay, and they wrote it down or tried it. And they were like, I want to see if this fool actually does this. And then it got passed down through history, and now we're reading about it. But same thing in Persia. One of the treatments that they used were baths, scorpion oil massages, which I thought was really interesting because how do you get the oil?
Right.
Because scorpions would not necessarily want their oil taken from them.
Right.
So. And what is scorpion? Anyway, a lot of questions there. Avoidance of eggs. Don't know why. Fresh or hard-boiled meat should be avoided, and fish. Rose water, Indian beans, and melon pips, which I'm not sure what that is. Rose water, Indian beans, and melon pips were also used as part of the treatment. They don't say exactly how they were used.
Oh, melon pips are seeds.
Oh, okay. Okay, so I'm assuming. But, okay. Mm-hmm. All right, well, yeah. Then you wind up with diverticulitis. So, yeah. But you, in reading that, I wondered to myself, like, okay, well, these are very specific things.
Right.
So I'm wondering, you know, at some point, something had to make you think this worked.
Right.
You know, like if a person had a stone, had abdominal pain, had all the symptoms, and you said, okay, go get some she-ass, and some saltpeter.
And go get the private
mix
part.
That, mix all that up. She asks. And does the person, is it a placebo effect, which is a measurable effect?
Well, that's true, yeah.
You know, or and they're coming back going, wow, that really worked, yeah. You know, so.
And what did they do with these substances? Did they drink them?
Say. I'm assuming they were elixirs that you would drink.
No, I read that they were urethral. You put them in through. It was a urethral infusion.
I did not read that.
Yeah, I read that.
Oh, urethral infusion. That sounds like the name of a really cool alternative band.
Yeah.
Urethral infusion.
And people, you can have that one. Brian's giving a freebie away.
Hey, I got urethral infusion tickets. Yeah. You going to go?
I'm going to see UI.
UI Nation, bro.
I'm a UI fan.
Hashtag UI Nation.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I also read that ancient India did the whole vegetarian diet thing, and they also did a urethral syringe of one of three things. Medicated milk, which Sushruta talked about quite often.
He said mother's milk before. Did he make a distinction?
Oh, that's right. Okay, maybe that's what I'm thinking.
Because we've come across him before.
Okay, but milk. Mm-hmm. Sushruta used a lot of milk.
He did, but remember, I don't remember which one. I think it was cataracts, where he said specifically mother's milk.
Yeah.
So did they make that distinction, or was it
just
milk?
It just said medicated milk.
So we can use almond milk.
And then, yeah.
It's soy, okay.
So a urethral syringe of medicated milk, alkalis, and then also clarified butter. But in my mind, I was thinking, I wonder if the clarified butter... I mean, surely they didn't inject that into the urethra thinking that that was going to somehow dissolve a stone. But I'm wondering if the clarified butter...
Stone but, is gone, but you had a heart attack.
Right. But I'm wondering if the clarified butter was to lubricate the urethra so that when you excrete,
it will come out.
It comes out more smoothly.
All I know about clarified butter is my wife took some on a camping trip we went on because I wanted butter for our morning pancakes. Yeah. And I was like, this isn't going to... And it was actually good. It worked out.
What?
I don't know what clarification... I mean, we're way off topic.
Maybe it doesn't break down as easily.
It's butter
or
that you can, like...
Maybe it doesn't get soft. Yeah. Maybe it doesn't get soft easily.
It was, like, liquidy.
Imagine. Oh.
Yeah.
Well, maybe that's why they injected it then, because it was liquidy.
No, it was, like, a liquidy, like, it looked like melted butter.
It looked like melted butter. Yeah, yeah. Oh, fascinating.
Yeah. Huh. And she's like, I'm taking clarified butter. I'm like, I want real butter.
She's like you're getting real clarified butter.
She always calls me a princess. She's like, stop being a princess. We're camping.
We're not glamping.
I'm like, we're having pancakes. I want butter and syrup.
Oh, God. So, okay, Brian, remember when I told you and the listeners, our five listeners, to get used to hearing about Sushruta because he was all over the place? We're going to talk about him again today. But like I just said, you know, the ancient Indians recommended this vegetarian diet and urethral syringe of all these different things. He recommended non-surgical treatments first. So he... Sushruta's opinion was that surgery for a bladder stone was the last resort. Okay. Sushruta thought that these bladder stones were formed due to abnormal phlegm, abnormal bile, air, or semen. So I don't know how. Abnormal in which ways? I don't know. The article did not go into greater detail, so I'll just leave you listeners with that little thought. Abnormal semen. But his preoperative treatment, you know, as I said, he was very detailed about like what he wanted you to do pre and post procedure or whatever. Well,
can I stop you right there?
Mm-hmm, sure, of course.
So did he do any sampling of anything to do a diagnostic? So he did semen samples, basically. Because he'd have to know that you had abnormal semen.
I guess. And as far as air, I think that referred to like gas.
Gas.
Yeah.
Huh.
So
a visit to him for an initial evaluation must have been quite eventful.
You're probably like, let's just skip to the Dr. Sushruta. Come on, let's just do the surgery. But anyway, his preoperative treatment was to anoint the body, whatever that means, cleanse the body with emetics and purgatives. And then offer prayers to the gods, Okay, so that's what they did. And then the lithotomy procedure itself is the following. The patient is laid on his back with his upper body in the attendant's lap with his waist elevated on a cloth cushion. Okay. Do you have
someone's
that
holding you.
Pictured
that's
in
nice.
Your mind? Yeah. Okay. Next, the patient's knees and elbows are contracted and bound.
Oh.
So, not like being hogtied, but tied nonetheless. And to me, this alone, this position of being like, you know, my elbows are restricted in a bent position, my knees are bent and you know, tied up. I mean, I'm a little bit claustrophobic. I would probably be having a panic attack just getting me into the surgical position.
But this is sounding more and more like that book that 50 Shades of Grey.
Okay, now the attendant that's helping Sushruta is of strong physique and unagitated mind. So he needs to be strong and in a good mood. And it's funny because the other day I had a friend that had surgery on a Friday, and I said, oh, you need to go in there and tell the surgery team, you know, make sure everybody's in a good mood because today is Friday, TGIF, y'all, because you want to make sure everybody's on their A game and doing what they're supposed to do and focusing and all that good stuff. And not annoyed. So if you had a bad night at the crib, you better get unagitated. Next, the surgeon, here comes clarified better again. It wasn't just used transurethrally. The surgeon rubs clarified butter into the left side of the umbilical region and presses firmly with his fist downwards until the stone is as low as possible. Okay, are you imagining that? Okay, next. The left index finger and middle finger of the surgeon with cut nails is dipped in oil. Not clarified butter. Dipped in oil and inserted into the rectum. These two fingers right here, Brian. Dipped in oil, inserted into the rectum. Pressing forwards until the stone is grasped and stands out like a tumor, like you described earlier. Okay? All right. Now, Sushruta warns at this point, upon grasping of the stone, if the patient faints, stop the procedure or the patient will surely die. So don't get crazy. If the patient faints, just stop. All right. On the left side of the raft of the perineum. Okay. Let me describe to you where the perineum is and what the raft is. Okay. So the perineum is the, otherwise known as the taint. It's the region between the anus and, on a man, the scrotum. So that little area right there, otherwise called the taint, right, is the perineum. Okay. So on a woman, it's the area between the opening of the vagina or the vulva and the anus. The raft is the midline. Okay. It's the middle. It's the part that connects the right and left sides of your body. Okay. So on a man, this raft, it appears like a line that goes between the left and right scrotal sac. Okay. So if you went from the anus up the perineum, you would see this little thin line of tissue, and then it keeps going to separate the right and left scrotal sacs on a man. Okay. So what they would do is they would make an incision to the left of that median raft. All right. As far as how far to the left of off of the midline they wanted to go the distance of a barley corn, which I Googled, which equates to about a fifth of an inch. So you find that median raft, the midline, okay? And then you move over to the left just about a fifth of an inch. And then you make an incision that's wide enough or long enough to excrete the stone, depending on how big that person's stone is, okay? So that the size of the incision could vary, okay? But you want to open it up enough to let the stone freely freely come out, because you want to take special care when removing the stone not to let it break into pieces or to leave any behind. Even the tiniest small residual fragment will grow into a larger stone again. So it was so important not to leave any of the particles behind. Post-procedure care on this, Sushruta was a little quiet. He basically just said sit in warm water, and that was to prevent the accumulation of blood. So, and then if you did accumulate blood, then he wanted you to have a urethral syringe of Kashira trees or something. I don't know. Some weird concoction of herbs through your urethra.
So the next big...
Well, hold on. Before we move on, so you being a man, because let's face it, this was, you know, men were more afflicted with this than women. What do you think about this procedure? Does it just make you like cringe?
Absolutely cringe. I think it's just like anything now. If you're in enough pain and somebody tells you, and Sushruta's around, and Sushruta did everything. So if somebody tells me Sushruta can handle it, I'm going to Sushruta if it's that way. From what I've seen with people in modern day, you know, with bladder stones, it had to have been just, you would have probably thought there was no other alternative at that point. And that 6,000 years ago, when was it? How long ago was this? 6,000 years ago?
600 BC, 600, yeah. So what, 3,000, yeah. 2,500 years
ago. So at
ago
that point, I'm sure you're like, well, I'm going to probably die from this, so I don't have any other option, you know, so that was probably it. But the second, when he talks about if they fainted, then the procedure had to stop, I'm sure we wouldn't have gotten through that procedure with me, because I wouldn't have
You'd have woken up and you'd have been like, hey, wait a minute, why isn't my taint hurting?
Yeah, yeah. Sir, we haven't even made it past the introductions. You faint every time.
We're going to have to give you some smelling salts.
Yeah, there's no way. So Sushruta's technique actually remained unchanged until we get to Rome, where like the next pivotal moment in the history of urology kind of comes about with a guy named Cornelius Celsus.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote a pivotal work in medicine called De Medica, which is an encyclopedia of medicine, where he talked about perineal lithotomy, where he really describes it in detail. So his first descriptions of lithotomy, he considered it to be, was considered to be, like I said earlier, a landmark in the history of urology. But his way of practicing it, which was very similar to the way that you described it with Sushruta, changed very little until the 18th century, which we'll talk about a little bit. So the technique that Celsus used is very similar to Sushruta, but he also makes a few other recommendations with his own technique. So he advised that the procedure should only be carried out in the springtime and only on males and females between the ages of 9 and 14. And the reason for that is particularly in males, like you mentioned, this is more prevalent in males.
Mm-hmm.
The reason for his ages in males is because the size of the prostate in adults makes getting to the bladder more difficult and more dangerous.
Oh, okay.
So in his experience, he cut it off.
So once they hit 14, puberty, basically, right, and the prostate starts to get...
Exactly.
Okay.
And so patients were instructed preoperatively to drink nothing but water and to exercise by walking to move the stone into the bladder neck. And for people who don't know what we're talking about, if you look at your bladder like a... I always think of an onion. Like if you look at like the shape of like a sweet onion where it's not completely round like a circle.
Yeah, it's oval.
It's an ovoid, right? And if you don't, like if you don't cut the ends off, like it has a little... It
comes to a point.
A neck, right.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's exactly what your bladder looks like. And so the neck of the bladder is the point where all the urine collects at a little area.
Which is at the bottom, right? By the way. Yeah.
And so it kind of like a funnel. It basically goes down into that area so it can go into the urethra.
Yeah.
And so some of the stuff when you look at anatomy, it's like a car. It's like, okay, this connects to this, this goes to this, this goes to this. So, and the whole purpose is so that you can get the urine from your bladder out your body.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so. But at any rate, the whole point was to get the stone into the neck of the bladder and so that you could have one central location to where you could get to it fairly easily.
Yeah.
And so if you're using your fingers to go up into the rectum to be able to push the stone and manipulate it with your fingers, you're going to have it somewhere you can get to it. And yeah. The bladder would be the place to get to it.
Yeah.
This is my assumption just from reading whatever.
Yeah,
whatever.
Yeah. So, that makes sense. Yeah.
But at any rate, he also recommended that the fingernails need to be cut and trimmed. The fact that they have to say that.
I know, right?
Yeah. I mean, at some
point. What were people doing with their manicures then?
Mm. Well, one of their assistants must have been like, you know, I had a case the other day. It didn't really go well. I don't even know what I did wrong. You know, let me see your hands.
He was bleeding so much. I don't know why there was so
much
blood.
Pain. He kept fainting. He
kept screaming.
So, but at any rate, the fingernail should be cut. And he also advocated for a strong and intelligent assistant to sit at the head of the patient to hold him down. And in some cases, two assistants, if the patient was strong and, mm-hmm. and large person. The procedure itself was very similar to Shishruta, which you just described. Two fingers inserted into the rectum with the right hand pressing down on the lower abdomen gently so as to avoid injuring the bladder from the stone. So the whole idea was to manipulate the bladder as much as you could to push and kind of work the stone into the neck.
You're using manual manipulation to get things where you want them. Okay.
Which it didn't say, but I wonder how painful that. I mean, we'll sidestep the fact that this person's got two fingers in your
right.
rectum, but how?
I mean, that alone in some people is enough to pleasure versus pain.
I'm only here for a cataract. What are you doing?
But yeah, no, I mean, just imagine when your bladder is full, imagine when your kid is little and they come run in on Sunday morning and hop in bed with you and your bladder is full and they're trying to snuggle up to you and their foot hits your bladder and you're like, oh my God, that hurts and I'm going to pee all over you. Just imagine, because you said that he had them drink a lot of water to fill their bladder.
Yeah, yeah.
Was it to fill their bladder,
he
I wonder,
I
or just
say,
to clean their urine maybe,
yeah,
or just to make
say,
it less?
I'm wondering if that was just the some sort of connection.
So maybe I'm a little off base here. I was just assuming that it would be a full bladder, but maybe not. No, because then the stone would float around in the full bladder. So never mind.
What I would think. But I would think maybe that just... for hydration purposes, just to have something since they didn't want him to eat anything. But and that's one thing when you read some of the stuff, like you really
you don't know. I know you want to.
Like,
I know
here?
You just want to pick their brain. You want to have a sit down. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and it had to have been probably through trial and error too. It's just like, well, maybe if I have the person just drink a lot of water, maybe that'll help A, B, and C. You know.
Yeah.
But at any rate, from there, he would make the incision, and in this case, the incision similar to Shishruta, the incision in this case was made in the shape of a crescent. And a second transverse incision was made at the opening of the neck of the bladder. So trying to visualize this, I'm trying to figure out exactly how they're, I mean, again, trial and error, you would know where that would be. But so now we've got two incisions.
I wonder why the crescent shape.
I think that had to do with the way the instrument, which I'm going to talk about next,
okay.
that he introduced.
Okay.
But I don't know. And I thought the same thing because you've got two incisions.
Yeah.
So I'm assuming it had more to do with the instrument. So the instrument that he used was a thin hook that was used with, and I'm quoting here, an upper end splayed out into a semicircle, polished and smooth on the outside surface in contact with the wound, and roughened on the side which holds the stone. So
yeah, it
and
had
then
to
the stone would be pulled out.
Kind of like hemostats that we use
for
certain things.
Yeah, that's the way
things.
I think of it.
Yeah, it has to have a gripper.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so this was probably done with alcohol to numb the patient. I mean, at least they give him something. Knock me out.
I'll have some Tito's vodka, please.
Yes. So this procedure, the way that Celsus did, like I said, went largely unchanged until the mid-18th century, which were different techniques to change things a little bit. But I thought that was really, really interesting. And keeping on the same line with Rome, Pliny the Elder, he prescribed infusions of peony, mint, or chickpeas to dissolve renal or vesicular stones, and also prescribed waters from an island near Sorrento and waters from Tongres as non-surgical treatments.
Mm-hmm.
He was one that did not believe in surgical. Mm-hmm. He thought it was too dangerous. Mm-hmm. And Galen, who was also a huge figure in early medicine, particularly Rome, he believed that abscesses, ulcerations, and kidneys of the kidney and hematuria were caused by calculi in the form of sand or larger stones. And he practiced lithotomy as described by Celsus. So again, Celsus kind of outlined exactly, but it doesn't say whether he was heavily inflamed. I mean, obviously, I think the techniques that came from India made its way to Rome via Greece and into Rome. So
yeah, speaking of Greece, Hippocrates, he had zero interest in surgical treatment of bladder stones. Mm-hmm. In fact, it's part of the Hippocratic Oath that he says, quote, I will not covet persons laboring under the stone, but will leave this to be done by men who are practitioners of this work, unquote. Basically, this was a warning to physicians not to perform surgeries, but rather to let the lowly non-physician surgeons, like the barber surgeons, do this type of work, which we've talked about before. He did not like invasive procedures. He also was very adamant that the bladder wounds were lethal. So he was a no-go.
Well, we see that a lot because they, as we go from Rome and we kind of, you know, follow the historical timeline and we go into the medieval period, there's a real hesitancy to perform lithotomy. Mm-hmm. And I don't know whether that's because of, you know, we're in the quote-unquote dark ages where some of the, the cultural shifts and things like that that have happened at this time. We've talked about some of the things with medicine kind of as it starts to formulate, you know, in academia and that kind of thing, who perform what and the hierarchy that starts to develop. But lithotomy was not readily practiced in medieval Europe. And one source I said was relegated to, and I'm going to put on my my theatrical English voice. You ready for this?
Yes, I'm ready.
It was relegated to barbers and low persons, rustics, idiots, and imbeciles, and what is worse, to base and presumptuous women who are not afraid to perform it.
Really, to
pearls?
Women?
Did you clutch
pearls? I did. Yes, I want to fan myself and lay on my fainting couch. Yes.
But the women, I think they were describing midwives or some sort of healer type person.
Yeah.
that would take up that role.
That makes sense.
And
yeah.
I thought that was really interesting. And so I guess reputable physicians didn't go anywhere near it back then.
Yeah.
And since lithotomy was not readily practiced, there were also attempts in medieval Europe to find non-surgical effective treatments to dissolve. And so the whole idea, they knew there was a stone. Is there any way to break this thing up or dissolve it? And so just like they did hundreds of years ago with the she-ass, they came up with other ways to do it. And so one gentleman by the name of D. Gordon prescribed 2 drams of scorpion ash. Scorpions come up again here. It's interesting. There must be something to it.
Huh.
This time it's scorpion ash. So I'm assuming you burned a scorpion and did something to it. So 2 drams of scorpion ash, 2 drams of ox blood, vine ash, hair, birds of trembling tails. I don't know what that is. Hatched eggs from which chickens have been removed. Jew stone. Sidestep that one. Bull's gallstone. Pepper, carrots, mallow, and saxifrage seeds, millet, and hornbeam. So I guess you take this to the local apothecary and hand it to him and be like, here you go. And
you're like, I have a bladder stone.
Oh,
here's,
dear, I'm
here's
all
my
out
stuff.
Of trembling tails. I'm so sorry. Is there a substitution? I mean, some of this stuff opens some questions. Like, I want to know, like,
I know.
Is there a shortage? Like, do I have to go to another county? Like, how long is this prescription good for?
Right,
like,
yeah.
Is there a copay? Right. You know? I have questions.
Well, you know, while you were talking about all that just now, it occurred to me when you said, do they burn the scorpions and use the ash? Remember the episode where we were talking about patent medicines and we were talking about snake oil and how the Chinese would boil, there was a specific kind of like Chinese water snake that they would boil and they would take the oil from that to use as medicinal purposes. And then, you know, snake oil salesmen from the great U.S. were just taking like water moccasins or, you know, whatever. I mean, maybe not water moccasins, but whatever kind of snake, any old kind of snake, and boiling it. And there was no medicinal effect because it wasn't the same kind of snake that they weren't using the right kind of snake. Anyway, so maybe the scorpion oil came from like a boiling process.
Well, it's shown up again
this.
And we're talking, you know, at least from the last one, a few hundred years of history. So was it a carryover of another remedy or was there something to it that someone said?
Well, if it's coming up in different parts of the world across hundreds of years separation in time, I think there must be something to it.
There was a guy by the name in the 14th century, I'm going to slaughter this one, but Guy de Chauliac. Anyway, he was the father of French surgery, but he wrote quite a bit about stone disease, but it appears he never performed lithotomy. He stressed the dangers of operations for calculi, and he believed the operation carried risks of convulsions, blood loss, and fistula. And a fistula is an abnormal connection between two structures.
Two things, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he reiterated ideal conditions for lithotomy by Celsus in the springtime, 9 to 14 years of age.
I wonder why in the springtime.
I think, and I'm going to get to that, actually.
Oh, okay, okay.
Because the humeral theory of disease, those four humors, quote-unquote, mm-hmm. had to be in a certain amount of balance. Mm-hmm. And if they were not in balance, then there was something wrong with you. Mm-hmm. And springtime was thought to be the time where those things should be at the optimal balance.
Oh,
from
okay.
what I gathered
okay.
and what I read, I might be getting okay. that wrong or misstating that.
But, no, that makes sense.
But performing lithotomy in the spring was based on restoring at the optimal time to yeah. restore those balances.
Yeah. Okay.
So
that makes sense.
Which is interesting because, again, you go from Shishruta, who Shishruta just happened to throw semen in there, but yeah. but there was a,
right.
that idea that there was some yeah. sort of imbalance of yeah. of humors or
yeah.
whatever. So
yeah. Most physicians and many throughout many parts of history didn't want to do any invasive procedures at all because, you know, that was that was beneath them. Let's talk about the people who would. So back in the earliest of days, stone cutters, or they were also called lithotomists, in the earliest of days, this was mostly a traveling profession. These people mostly were not educated and mostly were con men and mostly were incompetent. Now, I'm not saying all, but mostly back in the earliest of days. People who suffered from bladder stones, that was a rampant, you know, situation. Like, people were all over the place with these things. So, and they were desperate for help. So they didn't care about your qualifications or how long you were going to be in town. They were like, oh, the stonecutter's coming to town. Let's make us an appointment for Wednesday at 2 and go down there and get our stone cut out. But these men would come to town and they would perform as many of these lithotomies as they could. And then they would leave before patients started to die or have serious complications. Yeah. So, I mean, eventually, you know, kind of like the barber surgeons, eventually they would start to become more organized, and they, you know, eventually there was a guild, and so, you know, that's about the time where you started getting people that were competent and could really do a good job who were non-physicians. But in the earliest of days, these guys were you wanted to really just try to stay away from them if you could. In fact, some of these guys were so bad that it might even leave you wanting to cut out your own bladder stone. Like the person that I'm going to talk about next, which is a person who, mid-17th century, Jan de Duut was a blacksmith in Amsterdam. Okay. in his day, the mortality rate for lithotomy was about 40%. 40%. Twice he had undergone failed lithotomies. Okay. I don't know if it was from these itinerant lithotomists or what, but twice failed lithotomies. In his despair, he sent his wife off to the market, summoned his brother to come over and help him, and set to work removing the stone himself. Okay. So his brother comes over. His brother holds his scrotum out of the way while Jan de Duut held the stone in place with his own left hand, and in Jan de Duut's right hand, using a knife he had made just for this occasion, because remember, he was a blacksmith. So this was a lot of planning, by the way. This wasn't just a like, oh, while my wife's gone to the grocery store, I'm going to run in here and cut my stone out. No, that he planned this.
But
he made a knife.
For a second,
because
we both have siblings.
Yeah. And
I don't think there is a universe where if I ask my sister to come over because I need you to hold my scrotum, the rest is not even going to get said. Because once I said that, that's it. That might change the whole relationship.
She might try to have you committed. Yeah. She'll be calling your mom going, do you want to know?
Because our normal interaction is like, hey, I need you to come over. For what? I'm going to have to say something.
So Jan de Duut, like I said, he's with his left hand, he's holding this stone in place. And then with his right hand, he's using the knife that he made, and he cuts his perineum. Okay. Now, it is unclear, based on the way the story is told, exactly whose fingers were in Jan de Duut's rectum. So it could be that his brother was holding the scrotum with one hand and
He had something on his brother. Like, he's yeah. like, I'm going to tell your wife yeah. about all the dirt you've been doing.
You better get over here yeah. or else. Okay. The next part is, then, after he cut his perineum, he did a few squats to open up that wound enough to remove this large stone. Now, I'm imagining that the squats that he was doing was sort of the same way, you know, after I wash my jeans and dry my jeans and I put them on for the first time and I want, and they're my favorite jeans and I want them to feel fit just right, but I do a couple of squats just to kind of loosen them up in all the right places that I like. That's what I'm imagining he was doing, okay? So every girl who wears jeans knows this, what I'm talking about. All right. Next, he's not finished yet. Next, he rips a hole in his bladder and removes the stone. Guess how big this stone was.
How big was it?
It was the size of a hen's egg. It weighed 4 ounces. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Only after he ripped it open and pulled it out did he seek medical attention. he actually consulted a physician because now he's got this huge gaping wound, okay? But his wound never really healed properly, and he had continuous problems the rest of his life with it. But he had this stone set in gold so that he could keep it with him, and he would tell this fascinating story about himself over and over again. He even had his portrait painted. So if you Google search Jan de Doot, which his name is spelled J-A-N, D-E-D-O-O-T. Brian, do you have a picture?
I do. And looking at the picture, I can describe it to our 5 listeners. He looks like, it looks like a cereal box. And he's like, it looks like he's holding
it
some
looks
sort
like
of
the
egg
incredible edible
cereal.
Egg.
Yeah, like, and he's holding the stone in the shape of an egg. And he's got like a look on his face like part of this nutritious breakfast. And
actually, I think the look on his face is like, he's like saying, I'm trying to figure out which emoji I would use. If this were an emoji on my phone, in which circumstance would I use it? It's almost like I'm finished being exasperated by this. Like, it's done. It's finished.
Well, he's holding the instrument that he blacksmithed, and it looks like it
looks like a big butter knife.
It looks like a credit card.
It looks like a
really sharp
or
credit
like
card.
One of those shaving knives.
Yeah, yeah,
like
yeah,
a straight,
yeah.
like a what do they call it? A flat, like a straight razor.
Yeah. Well, this looks like a rigid edges. The way he's holding, I can't see if there's a handle on it, which I'm assuming he's holding the handle. But the way it's out of his hand, it looks like a credit card, and I'm sure it probably had
to pay his lithotomist,
yeah.
or to pay himself.
I'm sure it's what we can't see is there's a handle on it.
Yeah,
very small meat cleaver almost.
There's a picture of yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about his bangs. Cause first of all, he's dressed up. Okay. So he's got his black jacket and he's all buttoned up with a nice little, kerchief. You know, kerchief around his neck. But his bangs, his bangs are,
they're fire.
He looks effeminate.
No, that was the cut back then. Like, that was the way you had it done.
Okay.
And that was,
anyway, Jan de Doot was not the most incredibly good-looking guy.
Are you kidding me? Any tavern you go in and you open with that story, you're going to get all the ladies.
Well,
and then you
I don't
show
know.
Them
Are
scar.
You?
Then
Are
you?
You
show
I don't
scar.
Know. I don't know if I want to see that funky mess. I don't know. I think that might not.
Well, my next line.
Now,
would be,
I think I would be fascinated, right. but not in a sexually aroused way.
Right, but then my next line would be, do you want to see the scar?
I'd be like, hell yeah, but I'm not having sex with you after. But also what's interesting about this is he's standing in his portrait. He's not sitting. And the story goes that because he had this wound that wouldn't heal, he had continuous problems with it, it was probably hard for him to sit. Mm. So I thought that his was
so
a
maybe
fascinating
he
tale.
Pick up the ladies then and kind of, yeah.
Well,
still a good conversation starter.
Yeah. I mean, you know, there is that lithotomy position.
Ah.
So, anywho. Okay.
So, Christy, I have a few, this next part I'm going to talk about, there's some words in here that I'm going to slaughter, but okay. I'm going to go ahead and try as hard as I
all
can.
Right. Well,
so,
you know, you're the one that loves to pronounce things, so knock yourself out.
So, lithotomy, as we've talked about, is figuring out how to remove a stone from the bladder. As this technique started to kind of refine over the years, and remember, we didn't change much at this point. We're still in the 1800s, mm-hmm. and we haven't changed much from the way that it had been done since Celsus, right?
Mm-hmm.
So someone came along with the bright idea, well, why don't, instead of just taking out a very large stone, why don't we come up with some way to break this thing apart and then remove it?
Mm-hmm. Why don't we do what Shishrutis warned us not to
exactly.
do? Let's do it on purpose.
Why don't we try that?
Yeah.
And so the name of this technique becomes, and here we go with some of my slaughtering of words, lithotrity. And if I'm saying that wrong, it's L-I-T-H-O-T-R-I-T-Y. So it could be lithotrity. Anyway, I'm going to say lithotrity from here on out. So.
Okay, I think the way you say it is good.
Sounds
I think that's
sweet.
probably, yeah. I like that way better than the way
it sounds like someone trying
to
make themselves
before.
Sound more important back then.
Yeah.
And like, what do you practice? I practice lithotrity.
I just crush up stones.
It sounds better than that. So this technique is modified and finally begins to gain acceptance around the mid 19th century. A couple of pivotal players in the development of lithotrity are one guy in the 1824 by the name of Jean Civale, who developed his own instruments for grasping and fragmenting stones in the bladder. So one of the things he developed was an instrument called a trilabe, or trilab, which he used for that purpose to grasp and fragment the stone and then remove it. And he later modified that and developed another instrument called the litholabe, which was made of two metal tubes and one with, it's basically like a telescoping tube. So mm-hmm. one tube inside the other tube.
Uh-huh.
And so the inner tube had three curved arms. So you would insert the mm-hmm. into the urethra.
Mm-hmm.
You'd kind of be able to gain access, insert mm-hmm. this tube, and then you extend out the middle tube. And then
uh-huh.
three curved arms, on the end of that would grasp the stone and then basically suck it back in. Once you retrieve that inner arm,
uh-huh.
it has the stone, it kind of pulls it back in, then you take the whole thing out, and the whole stone
that's
will
come out.
That's
pretty advanced
for that time period. 1824,
yeah.
I figure the same thing. That is pretty ingenious way to think of trying to deal with it,
yeah.
too. So he modified that one. And later modified that one into something he called the lithotrite, which was an instrument that he used to crush the stone before he pulled it out.
Uh-huh.
And so that was, so he went from that, from actually extracting it that mm-hmm. way, to that's where he came up with the idea of actually crushing the stone.
I guess he probably came across stones that were too big to fit through the bore of mm-hmm. his outer diameter.
Or numerous stones
yeah.
and trying to figure
yeah.
out ways to be able to
yeah.
pull them all out.
Yeah.
And so again, he carried the procedure out with no anesthetic, but his rules were maximum of 5 minutes, and that was it.
Oh,
and
uh-huh.
he'd shut it down, and uh-huh. then he would do this in several sittings. So
uh-huh.
you got a maximum of 5 minutes. If I didn't get to where he needed to be, or if you passed out, then that was it.
Okay,
and you would have to come back for
several
sittings.
Let's think about that.
Yeah.
Let's break that down for just a second. Let's ruminate on this. Would you rather? I love to play Would You Rather. Would you rather have one miserable surgical procedure whereby they just get it over and done with, right? Takes an hour, whatever, but then you don't have to have it again. Or would you rather have 5 minute bursts of misery
multiple times? Too easy. I'm going to go, but now if we expand that, would you rather in that time have an hour-long surgery with no anesthesia, knowing that it's going to be completely brutal, or would you rather go 5 minutes at a time, as much as you can take, and have to come back for multiple sittings? We're talking time frame here, too. There's nothing. There's no anesthetic. There's no nothing except a little alcohol. So
I know. I actually don't know what I would
rather. I'm assuming you're going to pass
out. What would you
rather? Point.
Well, yeah, but if you pass out, they stop.
I think I'd rather get it all over with.
Yeah, I think I would too. I think I would too, because I think the fear for me would be that I wouldn't have the to go back and have it again. Like, knowing what I know, I'd be like,
yeah.
Because that's how I am with the dentist. I'm a complete freak about the dentist. Like, dude, I can't even go get my teeth cleaned without Xanax. I have to have a driver. It has to be well organized. No kidding. No, seriously. Like, people need to fly from Texas to come with me to go to the dentist. It's ridiculous. Yeah. Because one time when they were cleaning my teeth, they touched like I have receding gum line in one area, and they touched that
jumped
nerve.
Out
and
of that chair, huh?
Yeah. Oh, and the dentist, she was, oh God, she was so mean. And she was mean to the little girl, the little sweet assistant that was helping her. She was so mean to her. And I was pissed at how the dentist was talking to her assistant, and the assistant was being so sweet to me, and the dentist was being such a bitch to me. And I was like, she said, I said, wait, stop. You know, isn't there something else? Like, isn't there some other way for you to do what you're doing? Cause this hurts. Like, I can feel it hurts like nerve pain. And she was like, ugh. And she told the assistant to like put, I guess, lidocaine gel on my gums and let me sit for 5 minutes. And so the dentist left, and the little assistant was like, okay, I'm going to go get the lidocaine gel. Save it. First of all, she is so rude to you, I can't take it. And second of all, like, she's so mean. I'm not opening my mouth to her again. So I got up and I left. And on my way out, I told the front desk people, because it was like one of these dental, like one of these places where it's like a huge dentist company, you know, like a company. And, you know, I had to go there because of my insurance or whatever. And I walked out and I was like, hey, she is so mean, and she's so rude, and she was mean to the assistant, and she was rude to me, and she's not. And you can tell whoever would care. I don't know who that would be, but whoever might in this company might care. I am never coming back here again. I'm going to tell everybody I know not to come back here or to come here, because she is terrible. And so, she hurt me.
Wait, you went full Karen.
I went cray cray. And then after that, Xanax and a driver every time I go to the dentist. It's terrible. Mm-hmm. Sorry. I did not mean to digress.
Not at all.
But yeah, so I don't think I would have the stamina to go back for those for a second 5 minute burst.
Yeah, know what I know. Yeah.
Okay.
So right. Civiale was actually, it said in the reading that he was credited with inadvertently initiating minimally invasive surgery, because he crushed the stone using instruments passed through the urethra, mm-hmm. and then extracted it with his instrument, mm-hmm. thereby not making any incisions. And, you know, invasive surgery meaning that you would be cutting and making incisions,
right.
and opening the skin that way.
Right.
But then I'm like, no. I'm calling BS on that, because our Egyptian brethren uh-huh. actually were quite minimally invasive with the poor assistant that had to suck the stones out.
So, oh, yeah.
Yeah, they didn't cut. Yeah. They didn't do any cutting. So I'm not.
Yeah, so
not...
they should be the father of
yes,
whatever.
Yes,
yeah.
And that poor assistant.
Yeah.
So a couple of other key figures in the 1800s. In 1822, a gentleman by the name of Leroy de Etoy. That's my French. I don't think I said that right, but I thought it was cool his name was Leroy. Anyway, he introduced an instrument that he made called a lithoprion, and I'm not sure if I'm saying that right, but it's it has to be lithoprion. Okay. It was a straight, long instrument that was held by an assistant, and he added a central, sharp instrument that could drill into the stone and break it apart once it had been grasped. Mm-hmm. And this is not new, because this was actually proposed by a Greek physician hundreds and hundreds of years before, mm-hmm. But he couldn't figure out quite how to do it. And so this is a modification on that technique to develop an instrument that could actually pierce it, break it apart, and then extract.
Uh-huh.
So another famous guy by the name of Baron Hartup from Paris. I mean, I told you these names are very hard.
They are. They're very hard names this
episode.
Yeah,
and I don't speak French. I should have paid attention in language classes. Anyway, he introduced his percutter, which was grasped the calculus between two parallel blades and pushed smaller blades in with an external mallet. So if you want to imagine here, same idea, we're cannulizing the urethra, introducing mm-hmm. the instrument, okay, and then this thing had two blades that would come out, and then he would, through the cannula that he created, he would take another instrument with small blades in and hammer them in with a mallet. So he's using a mallet to try to break the stone apart. The big deal here is that before that, all the efforts to break the stone mm-hmm. apart using instruments introduced through the urethra mm-hmm. were done by a screwing mechanism. So
okay.
you take something to drill into the stone to break it apart.
Okay.
His idea was no.
And now
if we're
you're
break
like
it apart,
tap,
we're gonna,
tap.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
We're going to tap that. Sorry. I had to.
And you know, my mind was just like, my ears were like,
So in 1878, a guy by the name of Henry J. Bigelow, a Boston urologist, started to kind of go, okay, well, wait a minute. This whole idea of breaking the stone apart is a good idea, but here's the problem with this. And this is what Shishruta warned, right? He didn't necessarily reference Shishruta, but he's like on the same wavelength as Shishruta because he's like, we can't just be breaking this stuff up because not only are you going to wind up with retained fragments of the stone itself, which you mentioned earlier will eventually result in another stone.
Right.
You're also going to wind up with retained sharp fragments of the instruments you're using.
Yeah.
So you've got a whole lot of issues
here. Dangerous.
Right. And so this is not necessarily the best way to go unless you can remove everything. The fragments that of the instruments you've used that haven't broken apart and all the pieces of the stone.
Yeah.
So he developed his own instrument, which he called a lithotrite, which was harder and stronger with the goal of removing all the stone fragments and could actually crush the larger stones, like our guy Dedute had. Mm-hmm. he had the advantage at this time, because we're at 1878 here, of anesthesia. So, you know, we're after the Civil War where they've at least come up with, at least give me some chloroform and do something. So he would fill the bladder, crush the stone, and evacuate the fragments all in one sitting. And he called this lithopaxy. And so it said fill the bladder, and I'm assuming with water. It didn't say exactly with what, but I think that's what they used. He would actually expand it by filling it.
To distend it.
And then flush it and flush all the particles out. So he modified and developed a large caliber evacuation system so that all the debris from the bladder was removed. Mm-hmm. And this was actually very important in the history of this procedure because the mortality from lithotrity dropped from 24% to 2.4%, all because of this.
And I read that. That's staggering. Yeah. And also, I was wondering, like, I wonder how they knew that they got all the fragments out. Because there was no way to, that was before x-ray or anything. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know.
I guess they just go by.
Maybe they would just flush out the bladder multiple times to make sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting.
Another gentleman by the name of Hugh Hampton Young was influential at this time because he developed something known as cystoscopic lithotrity. That was our third take.
Wow, I think it was more than three, but maybe I should leave all of them in.
Anyway, he developed this cool thing where he used a camera. And so...
you could have just said that.
Yeah, sorry. This was with the help of something called the Neitz cytoscope, which was developed around around the time of the late 1800s, early 1900s. Uh-huh. So this was around 1901.
Uh-huh.
And there was something called the Hopkins rod lens system. These two things developed together, he used to develop his own scope to be able to assess bladder stones.
Mm-hmm.
And then one other interesting story from the 1800s I thought was really interesting. A gentleman by the name of Henry Thompson from the University College Hospital. A dignitary by the name of Leopold I from Belgium went to visit his niece and was seized with the agonies of bladder stone. Okay?
Yes.
And so Civiale, who we mentioned earlier, who was very influential, he was summoned from Paris and after several attempts was unsuccessful at removing the stone. So Civiale recommended, and just physician referral, right?
Yeah.
He recommended Henry Thompson take a stab at this. No pun intended.
That was a good one, Brian. Yeah. Good one.
I try to throw one in every time.
Yeah, I know.
And so Thompson was actually a little nervous. He was like, I don't want to do this on a...
What? Why are you giving this to me? Why are you giving me the hard one?
Yeah, and I think Civiale, like...
Are you setting me up?
Took one half-assed attempt, and he's like,
sorry, can't help you.
And he's the guy, right? And so he sent him to Thompson, and Thompson actually wrote a letter to his wife the night before talking about how nervous
he was. Stressed out.
Yeah, he's like, dude, this isn't what I signed up for.
I'm real worried. Biting my nails over here.
Yeah, and so he was ultimately successful. And the important part about this story is that the king, he was fine afterwards. And so he didn't have any complications. Mm-hmm. And remember, at this point, and this happened in 1862.
Yeah.
And at this point, we're still a high complication rate. We're still at
high mortality rate.
Right, 24%. Mm-hmm. And so he's like, well, wait a minute. No complications whatsoever? Like, what did I do?
Wait a minute.
Yeah, something's up. And other people even tried.
Let me write this down, what I did.
But years later, he thought about, like, why he had such a good experience, and it hit him. So infection control had been understood and started to be widely accepted at this point. And so as he starts to look back, he realized that because this was a king, and this was such an important procedure, he used fresh, unpacked, sterile wrappings on the instruments that were brand new instruments that were only going to be used on the King.
I don't think they were sterile because I read the same thing. They weren't sterile, but they were unused. They had never been used on anyone. Said, they were oiled and all of that. Yeah.
But this said fresh, unpacked instruments in sterile wrappings. So maybe they weren't sterile themselves, but the wrappings themselves were.
But
sterile.
I don't think they knew about sterile procedure.
I thought that was interesting too. But the interesting thing is that he realized that this is what did it. Is the fact that, and he looked at his counterparts at the time, especially really big names in urology like Civiale, who used the same, and it hit him. He's like, they're using the same instruments on everybody.
They just go from one urethra to the next.
Not even cleaning them with soap and water.
And they didn't even wash their hands or, I mean, I remember an episode that we did and I talked about this. The dirtier their white coats were, the bloodier, the more patients thought they were good at their jobs. Yeah. Like, the dirtier and messier they looked, the better outcomes people thought they would have with this doctor.
Mm-hmm. And so for his...
Can you imagine your doctor walking in with like dirty hands and bloody white lab coat? I mean, just a bloody mess. Ugh. Okay, go ahead.
So for his work and for his saving the King, he was knighted in 1867.
Good for him.
But I thought it was really interesting that he actually made that connection.
Yeah.
Put two and two together. I wonder if other because we're at 1862 with 1867, so other physicians at that time had to have been like, I wonder if I keep things clean, people don't die.
Yeah, but you know, as you know, changes in medicine can be very slow because people get dug into, well, this is the way I've been doing it, and I feel comfortable with this methodology because this works for me or whatever, or... You know, my mortality rate is not that bad compared to most people. So I know I'm just going to do what I know. It's very hard to get change to take place in medicine or actually in all professions, but, you know, especially in science.
Well, think about back then, it was because so-and-so said. And
right.
So there were no white papers. It was basically like, this guy said this, and the word of mouth of like, so-and-so is doing this and that. You know?
Yeah, and only the people that... you know, have a certain personality where they don't put their egos in front of, you know, the science.
But the people who were listened to at that time were the people who had clout. And you could have been totally wrong.
Yeah.
And had clout at that time. And then the person who was right about things didn't have enough, you know.
It's horrifying. Okay, so before we wrap this up and conclude our episode here, I want to talk about I want to talk about a story that happened around the late 1700s. So there was this Colonel Claude Martin. I don't know what country we're talking. He suffered from a bladder stone that made it painful to urinate as well as ride a horse. Okay. So he was afraid to have surgery because he knew how painful it could be and that very often it was deadly. So he... like my yonder dude, he was one of few people to operate on his own body. And this is how he did it, Brian. Okay, brace yourself, my friend. You're going to need to brace yourself. He inserted... Oh, you're going to love this because your mom owned a knitting store. Mm-hmm. He inserted a knitting needle through his urethra and into his bladder to, quote... file small fragments off the stone to break it down, unquote. And he didn't only do this once. He repeated this procedure on himself. Wait for it. 3 times a day for 6 months. And guess what, Brian? The stone completely disappeared. What? 3 times a day for 6 months. That's 180 times three.
I just remember when I was a kid, because you mentioned my mom owned a knitting store, so I grew up around nothing but yarn and all this stuff. And when I was little, I would take her knitting needles and make swords and like do all kinds of stuff. She was always asking the question, where's my knitting needle? I'm going to have to tell her this story.
No, you know how I told you when we were talking about was it the nose job thing or whatever? Oh, we were talking about self-mutilation and how I don't know if I could do it. I was like, I can't even remove my own splinter. I swear to God, last night I was thinking about this because I got a splinter in my toe. You know, there were some metal shavings on the floor and I had flip-flops on. And then I got in the car and I was like, something's wrong with my second toe. It feels like there's like a sticker or something. And I started trying to, and it was dark and I was trying to feel to get it out. And every time I would rub my finger across that area, it would hurt. So I finally, you know, got my phone light out and saw I had a little teeny tiny sliver of a metal shaving in there. And it was so hard to remove it because I was like, oh, it's going to hurt. But I'm like, I mean, you stick a kneading needle. I don't even want to stick a kneading needle in my urethra, much less if I had a urethra that was way longer than mine is. I mean, I can't even imagine. Okay, one more thing that I want to say about this before we end. When you were talking about Rome earlier, in my research, I read where one of the most feared and hated Roman emperors, Tiberius, had ordered his torturers to tie up their victims' penises. Mm-hmm. So they couldn't urinate. So they would have this sensation of not being able to urinate. Mm-hmm. Yeah, isn't that terrible? Can you imagine?
When you're in the military, you get what's called a detail. Okay. Mm-hmm. People who don't know what a detail is, a detail is a job, okay, or a duty, a work. And so when you're enlisted, which means you always get the low end of the stick, they'll say, I need 4 volunteers. And people who know about the military say, don't ever volunteer for anything, which is true.
Yeah.
You won't know what the detail is 9 times out of 10, but they'll say, I need 4 guys. That's usually what they'll say. I need 4 guys. And you're like, and so you know.
And now, before you go in the military, do you know not to volunteer?
If you have,
or is that something you learn the hard way?
No, that's the thing that people will tell you. Don't ever volunteer for anything.
Okay.
And then when you get there, they'll say, I know all you've been told never volunteer for anything, but that's not, you know. I'm like, I'm not falling for that. So at any rate, you're going to wind up on a detail at some point. So I say all this to say that I wonder which lower enlisted guys were on that detail. Because the order went out, I want you to grab their penises and tie them up.
Right.
And the one guy goes, I'm not doing that.
Yeah.
So he told his sergeant, you need to get some guys and tie these penises up. And the sergeant was like, I'm not doing that. And so he went down and found the lowest guys he could. Be like, you 4, let's go. And those guys they were responsible for it. So yeah, I don't know. That just hit me when you said that.
Or maybe the most masochistic, or not masochistic, but not masochistic. That's
so
not the word
I'm looking
for.
So they killed the prisoners afterwards, or? Was it, or did it?
No, and you know what's worse about this is that not only did he, you know, grab these people and torture them this way, but before he tortured them by tying up their penises, he would bring them in and give them all this wine and get them really drunk so that they had to, because, you know, when you drink alcohol, you have to pee a lot. And so he would get them where their bladders were really full, and then they would take them and tie them up.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Not for the purpose of getting them drunk so they don't feel the sensation. Not for an anesthetic. So
I think that what would hurt more than anything else is just having my penis tied up, more than being able to have it to pee. I'm sure that once I had to pee, that would make it worse. But
if you have something tied around your penis, tight enough where no urine can come out, that's going to become like strangulated. So it's going to become numb. It's going to get red and hot and swollen first. And then eventually it's going to become numb. And then I guess what you're going to be fretting about is the fact that you can't pee. And I need to pee right now. So I'm feeling like, oh, that's got to be so miserable. I know.
Yeah,
I know.
Good.
It's just terrible. So interesting. The only other anecdote I have about bladder stones is my sweet, sweet, sweet Shih Tzu dog, Matilda. Oh, I loved her so much, but she had bladder stones and she had incontinence. And poor thing, she was just... I guess that's the thing with Shih Tzus is that they get bladder stones. Anyway, that's all I have, Brian. Do you have anything else?
That's all I got. I got to pee, though.
Okay, well, that's a wrap, guys. Thanks again for listening to us, and we hope you join us next week for another exciting episode of Curious Medicine.